All right, I'm the next speaker. And as I mentioned the introduction, I'm Kathleen Dellett from Iowa State University, and I'm in both the Departments of Agronomy and Horticulture, working in organic agriculture. And after listening to George talk, I can say this is basically level one organic farming and a mixture of level two and three. But the majority of farmers that we work with that come to the university for help are starting out, they're transitioning, or early organic farmers. Those that are already in what George calls level two and level three pretty much have developed the systems on their own or outside of the university's help, primarily through organic farmer networks. And it's really good to hear George describe it that way and have this as a basis for the discussion for the rest of the session. Okay, if I can go to the next slide, okay. I'm going to back up a little bit and give some of the logistics, I call it, for organic, for those in the audience that aren't familiar with all the rules and regulations underlying organic production. And I like to refer to the original National Organic Standard Board description of organic because it focuses on what George was talking about, the principles, the agroecological principles upon which pest management is derived, biodiversity, biological cycles, and soil biological activity. That's what organic farming emphasizes. But it also emphasizes minimal use of off-farm inputs. So that level one of input substitution is somewhat problematic because of the definition and the encouragement to use as much on-farm inputs as possible. But sometimes, as you'll hear, farmers feel it's necessary to bring in inputs. Just a snapshot for those of you that aren't familiar with the statistics. Organic has grown leaps and bounds in the United States from little less than 1 million acres in 92 to 4.1 million acres in 2005. That was the last USDA census, so a 300% increase in acreage. It's now a $21 billion total industry in the United States. We are the largest consumers of organic food in the world. The annual growth rate in the last 5 years has been going up 15 to 20%. Of course, with the recession, everything's dropped back somewhat, but it's still growing. And why Iowa State? A lot of people say, why does Iowa State have an organic program? We actually have the fourth largest number of organic farmers in the United States, and the organic farmers were very interested in having a research and extension position in organic. So if you look at this map, it's by ERS, you can get on their website, and you can see the darker colored states are where the highest number of organic production is. And the lighter ones down here, we'll be hearing from some of them, try to get more organic going in their states. Basically, there's two types of organic producers in Iowa and probably primarily everywhere, the commercial scale and the local market scale. The commercial scale fills out their census papers, so we know that there are exactly 522 farmers who identify themselves as organic in Iowa. And they're farming about 100,000 organic acres. This is from the IDALS, Iowa Department of Ag and Land Stewardship's organic program, which is a public certification board that's accredited by USDA National Organic Program. Primary crops in the commercial scale in those 100,000 acres, corn, soy, oats, and alfalfa. So that's primarily what my research is directed to. I'm also in the Department of Horticulture, and that is primarily what the local market organic farmers are growing. And their numbers are harder to get as far as acreage and number of producers, but it's definitely growing too, particularly as what George is referring to, this farmers market and local food scene. This is actually Ron Roseman, one of the farmers that George mentioned as being at level three, and I can attest to that too. I've learned a lot from working with Ron and his family, and we do a lot of on-farm trials at his farm. George covered this brilliantly, so I won't go into a lot of description about it, but just to reinforce that pest management is based on principles of ecology and agroecology. Having biodiversity, closed energy flows, feedback mechanisms for biotic regulation, stability of production, and then hopefully striving for that more complex, more stable, dynamic equilibrium. But coming down to the field level, as we say, some key requirements in the rules are that growers are required to maintain soil health and biodiversity. Prevention of insect pests and diseases is also in the rules, and that basically leads to conservation of beneficial insects, I would say. The majority of organic farmers, if you ask them how they're preventing, yes, they're using tolerant or resistant varieties, but also they make a big effort to conserve their beneficial insects and beneficial microorganisms, I should say, too. And in the case of using organic compliant pesticides that are pesticides that have been vetted and are considered naturally mined or biologically based, using the least toxic one available. And there are differences in that too, as I'll show you. Weed management, using combination biological, mechanical, and cultural weed management, including crop rotations and cover crops. So this just shows some of the lacewing beneficial insects, diverse operations, including cover crops in between organic orchard rows here, row covers to prevent insects from colonizing brassica crops. And then one of the more common organic treatments you'll see on some organic horticultural farms is garlic barrier, primarily garlic. We have a variety of studies going on at our research stations, and the ones I'm going to cover today are bean leaf beetle on soybean. Primarily, it does some damage as far as reducing yield, but it's more important for downgrading quality of organic soybeans because it vectors bean pod mottle virus and also opens infection sites from some other fungi that can downgrade the quality of the organic soybean. Soybean aphid has become a problem more recently in Iowa and throughout the Midwest, and our next speaker will cover this more. Vectors soybean mosaic virus and also can lead to a decrease in yield just by cutting back on the photosynthesis in the plant. And on the horticultural side, squash bug and cucumber beetle are listed as the most important pests in squash production, organic squash production. They cause yield decline, and the beetle also vectors bacterial wilt. And last, kiling moth and plum curculio as a suite of pests on organic apples that cause economic damage to the crop. So the first group I want to talk about are the soybean pests that we look at in organic soybeans. And this is at our LTAR, Long-Term Agroecological Research Site in Greenfield, Iowa. And this is now a 12-year comparison of conventional organic crops. This is a flyover of the 44 plots showing four rotations and five crops total. Close-up of the quarter-acre plots of our organic soybean plots. And so we examined pest management within those LTARs, and then we have some side projects where we also do specifically pest management treatments. Oops, sorry. So the research questions, the first one has to do with yields and increasing yields in organic systems, minimizing the need for external inputs. But then for this symposium today, to concentrate on the second major research question we're asking there, what cropping system configurations and soil management practices will increase crop competitiveness with weeds, build soil fertility, and suppress insect pests, nematodes, and diseases? So our system comparisons, they are comparing the conventional corn-soybean rotation, which is the predominant rotation in Iowa, versus three other organic rotations, organic corn-soybean oat-alfalfa, and then keeping the alfalfa for a second year and going back to corn. And then the shortest allowable certified organic rotation is soybean winter wheat with frost seeding of red clover and then back to soybean. And all crops and all rotation are grown annually to deal with year-to-year and weather differences. And we follow local practices both for conventional and organic production. So we're using swine hoop house compost from the ISU research farm. Provides about 90 kilograms per hectare of nitrogen for the corn crop and 30 kilograms per hectare for the oat crop. But what the soil scientists tell us, Cindy Camberdell from National Soil Tilth Lab that's working with the project, it's the rotating the crops with the grasses and legumes. In this case, we started out with crimson, now we switch to red clover. And wheat and also the oats and alfalfa is what provides the nutrients and helps manage the insects, weeds, and diseases in the system. So here's a close-up of one of the organic corn plots, and this is just a breakdown of all the parameters we're looking at. And for this talk today, I'm going to concentrate on the pest insects. Plant pathogens, non-existent. We monitor for them, but we have not had any. And soybean cyst nematodes, as George mentioned, we're trying really hard to get that steak dinner bet from Dr. Bird that we can find some cyst nematode problems on the organic fields. But actually, we have not had a problem on either the organic or conventional fields. So I think the soil's really healthy there. Okay, so bean leaf beetle, this is the critter right here. It comes in three shades, and the predominant one is this copper reddish color. Ceratoma trifurcata, we first noticed it around 1997, and at that point, some organic tofu beans, which are prized for their white seed coat, started showing this discoloration, and it was determined that it was the bean pod model virus that was vectored by the bean leaf beetle. And that rate started increasing so much to 2000 that growers were actually getting their beans rejected because of discoloration. Now, it turned out it was really more aesthetic than food quality. It didn't make a difference that much in the tofu. Iowa State Food Science Department did numerous experiments with it and determined that. However, the Japanese buyers primarily wanted that white seed coat, so we were asked to do some treatment experiments. As I mentioned, it also opens infection sites for other staining fungi, Cercospora, Fusarium, and a few more. So we did extensive trials. We published it this year, examining these organic compliant treatments for bean leaf beetle and staining reduction. And here's the bottom line. Neither the bean leaf beetle populations or soybean staining was reduced with the organic sprays. So here's the control, and you can see everything looks very much like the control. So that was exciting for folks that are already at level 2 and level 3 of organic production, because their theory is nature will take care of itself. As a matter of fact, when I told this one organic farmer I was doing this study, he said, "Do you know the first order of business is if you have a pest problem, walk away. Come back in a week, see if it's still there. If it's there after 2 weeks, then you might start praying. But otherwise, we're not going to do anything about it." So for that kind of mentality, this rang true, that spraying did not reduce any of the beetle populations or staining. However, we did see a difference with varieties as far as staining. This Schillinger 290F consistently showed a lower amount of staining. So we did actually switch to this variety at our long-term site because of that difference. Okay, moving on to soybean aphid. It originated as a problem, quote unquote, around 2004, but it was still considered a minor problem because we surveyed for beneficial insects in the field and found this many beneficial insects out there doing their job. So they were primarily keeping those aphid populations in check, particularly these ladybird beetles, which a lot of people have a problem with when they start coming into the houses in the fall. But I always tell them, look how many aphids they can eat. So it's something that's definitely necessary and helpful to the system. So contrary to the beetle, which is a larger insect, a harder shell, the soybean aphids were easier to manage with organic compliant treatments. So this neem product, it was Neemix, it's the bottom line here. You can see definite reduction in aphid numbers compared to the control, the white bar here. So as a matter of fact, after this study, some organic farmers started using neem. We didn't recommend it because we felt like there were enough natural enemies out there that they didn't have to worry about reducing their aphid populations. But those in what you would say level one, I guess, were still interested in using a product, and started using more neem. One thing we showed consistently throughout all these studies was, spraying or not, the organic crops were as high yielding as the conventional. So this was in the 10th year of the LTAR plots. We obtained 4 metric tons per hectare in both the organic and conventional soybean. That's about 60 bushels an acre. And the organic corn was actually surpassed the conventional corn that year. So, and this was out without using any spray treatments at all. So that was good news for the organic farmers. And then they always want to know the bottom line. So in the bottom line, the organic returns to labor management over 9 years, this is comparing returns to labor management for 9 years of the LTAR plots, were twice as great as the conventional returns. So here's the conventional corn versus the organic soybean. And in the conventional, we didn't grow oats or alfalfa, so there really wasn't a comparison there. Okay, moving on to the horticultural crops, organic squash pest management. What the organic farmers traditionally do is rotate their crops, which is very important in with dealing with insect and disease management. And usually following squash, or usually they follow corn or a leguminous crop with the squash. And definitely here, there is a matter of more tolerant varieties. The winter squashes tend to be much more tolerant of insect pests than summer squash. I mentioned earlier on, the row covers are really important. A lot of folks are using these floating row covers until flowering to avoid the squash bug and cucumber. And then if they keep the row covers on all season, they'll use these bee boxes so that pollination is not impaired. Natural enemies of the squash bug do exist. This is Trichopoda penipes, a parasitic fly that can parasitize the squash bug. So it's good not to use spray to have the beneficial insects still occurring in the fields. But some folks that were not using the row covers because of labor issues, it is labor intensive to put on the row covers and take them off, they were spraying with this kaolin clay product called Surround. So we did some work on that and published on the results of that experiment, and I'll show that next. I just wanted to say that this research was supported by Gerber Baby Food. I don't know if you've seen their organic line called Tender Harvest, and one of their premier products is this butternut squash and corn organic baby food. So they were interested in getting more organic squash production, and they had heard from their growers that there was a problem with squash bugs and cucumber beetles, and they wanted us to look into it. And as it turned out, we were getting such high yields anyway. I'll show you the results here. So here's the floating row covers that we floated over and tacked down to protect against the squash bug and the cucumber beetles. The other treatment that we used was an intercrop, can't really see it too well here, of buckwheat with the squash, because organic growers in Washington State University had recommended this as a practice to attract the beneficial insect, using it as an insectary plant, but also to confuse the pest insect. So when they would be flying over looking for the squash, they would see a mixture of the buckwheat and the squash and would not land. However, we did find that the squash bugs were, and then comparing this to the row covers and control, and squash bugs were decreased under the row covers, and including the cucumber beetles too. Surround didn't really do that much of a difference. Here's the control here. So, and here's the buckwheat. Some reduction compared to the control, but no statistical difference. But the buckwheat was horrible for competitiveness. So here's the yields: control, surround, buckwheat, and the row cover. So the good news was that the row cover reduced the squash bugs, and we didn't see a reduction in yield. Because as you can see here, we put the row cover on, it somewhat smashes the squash underneath. So a lot of growers are worried about reduction in yields. We didn't see any reduction in yields, and the surround didn't reduce yields either. But as far as the insect pests, surround was not that beneficial. Okay, moving to the last system, organic apple ecosystems. That is considered the most intensive pest management system in all of the organic crops. What we say is to start out with scab-resistant cultivars. Scab is the worst disease in apple production. And so if you start out with scab-resistant cultivars, you're going to have a big leg up there. A lot of folks don't like the flavor or texture of the scab-resistant cultivars and insist on using the scabby, as we call them, cultivars. And so they will be required to use a more intensive spray program for organic disease control. Multiple cultivars are always best for pollination and biodiversity. Having the insectary plants and cover crops in the tree middles, I think we're going to hear something about that later on in an orchard system, really helps attract the beneficial insects. Monitoring codling moth and plum curculio is essential, and then there's no way around it. I think this is primarily going to always stay what George would call level one, because it's a very management intensive, spray intensive system. So growers, organic growers that I work with use a combination of surround, mating disruption to affect the codling moth mating system. They also use codling moth granulosis virus, a virus that can infect the codling moth and lower the reproductive capacity. A new organic insecticide called, it comes from the fungus called spinosad. It's called Entrust commercially. So it's a multiple approach system. And here's the plum curculio and codling moth. And here's what the apples look like when they're coated with the surround. There's a scab, if you've never seen it. It's the reason behind the high rate of spray in organic orchards in areas of high humidity in the Midwest and Northeast. A lot of pressure more recently from consumers and environmental groups for less spray of any type, particularly copper, because currently folks are spraying copper and sulfur against scab in organic orchards that where they are not using scab-resistant varieties. But I think a big push to educate consumers to the benefits of apples, organic apples, without copper and sulfur sprays will really help push the approval rating for these scab-resistant varieties. The ones that we work with are Gold Rush, for example. There's a whole host of them, Enterprise, Liberty, Priscilla. And then when I was on sabbatical in New Zealand, we worked with this organic scab-resistant cultivar named Pinky that I'm trying to get introduced here in the U.S. New Zealand's very sophisticated. If you got to hear the COSA speaker last night, Hugh Campbell, he's also speaking in the other session about organic in New Zealand. They have a very sophisticated organic production system there. And they put, for example, all the organic growers log on to the codling moth flights and determine from their area when the codling moths are flying and get the biofix and are able to establish their spray programs based on this computer model here, which is really sophisticated. We don't have that for Iowa yet. The apple orchard that we work with in Iowa, the organic orchard, the goal of this family farm is to get their level less than 5% plum curculio damage, codling moth damage at the end of the season. You can see among the different varieties, you know, Enterprise, which is my favorite scab-resistant variety, could get the plum curculio down to 1.5% and codling moth at 3%. You'll never see 0% in organic orchard, but it's really good to see this, to strive for 5% or less damage. And as I mentioned, it's a multiple pronged approach that they use, so it's very difficult to separate out exactly what's causing each effect, but the overall effect is to get it lower than 5% damage. And then the good news, a lot of folks are worried that that surround clay would be damaging beneficial insects in the system, but I had a grad student who did intensive monitoring. Here's the control, here's surround, and then there was a system with surround and apple maggot balls, sticky balls to attract and collect apple maggots in the system. And that looks like it did lower it a little bit, but not as much as the control. So there was no damage to the beneficial insects from using the kaolin clay. So in summary, as George mentioned, maintaining that systems approach is required. Prevention with resistant and tolerant varieties is critical in organic systems. I'm happy to say that we have a new soybean aphid resistant variety that we trialed into this year. And it's non-genetically modified, which is one of the rules for organic, that you can't have any transgenic crops. So that's the good news there. They just harvested it while I was here, so I don't know the yields yet. My suspicion is they're slightly lower than the non-soybean aphid resistant varieties, but still, if you don't have to spray or worry about soybean aphid, a little yield dip could be fine. And as George mentioned, usually, and especially in level one, if you're going to introduce any spray treatments into your organic system, I still go with OMRI, Organic Material Review Institute. It has to be finally approved by the National Organic Program, but I recommend the first step is to work with OMRI to get approval for any spray treatment, new spray treatments, because I deal with a lot of manufacturers who want us to trial their organic sprays. First thing I ask, do you have OMRI approval? If you don't, I connect them to OMRI, and they work through them to get approval before we'll test it in our fields. And usually, as I mentioned, the organic farmers are very, and George did too, they're a very innovative lot. And when pests develop, the alternative solutions usually develop alongside with that. For example, when the stained soybeans became such a big problem in 2000, they developed systems to remove the hulls in the cleaning process. And that's where primarily staining was located, on the hulls. So they did that. And also, they developed a new market too. They didn't concentrate so much on the Japanese tofu market, where that clean white seed coat was demanded. a new domestic organic soy milk and TVP, texturized vegetable protein, market was developed to deal with stained soybeans. So really, if you ask organic farmers today, do you worry about staining in your soybeans? Basically, they'll say no, because they have markets, domestic markets. I pass around my webpage because it's a lot of times it's easier to go to the written results under this link here. You'll see all these reports that I talked about today. So thank you very much. And we have, again, 5 minutes for discussion before we bring our next speaker. Any questions? I didn't present the soybean cyst nematode data. I'm sorry, George is going to cry, but you know, showing 100 or less eggs is not that exciting. So that's basically what we find each year, is less than 100 eggs. And the threshold level that Iowa State says where you should begin to be concerned at all is something like 2,000 eggs per, is it CC, the unit that they look at. So we've never had a nematode problem. And I'm sure it has a lot to do with the rotations and also the compost and manure that's put in the system, Pat.
So, what's your impression of the obstacles in moving organic producers from level one, and researchers too, like myself, from level one to level three? I mean, you know, it's a lot of what's presented there, and a lot of experienced growers in North Dakota are playing right now with herbicides. I mean, they're all OMRI approved, but so it's kind of the same mentality. I mean, they may be less toxic, but they're non-selective. So I mean, what is the obstacle that is preventing? I would guess some of the growers that you're talking with and working with also are not. I mean, they're beyond transition. They're experienced organic producers.
Right.
What are those obstacles that are preventing more growers from moving to
one? Right. The excellent question. I think we should keep asking that throughout the symposium and definitely come back to it at the end of the session. For researchers, it's quite simple. When the manufacturer comes to you and gives you a product to test, it's, you know, especially in these budget crisis days, it's difficult to refuse. You know, they'll pay an average of $4,000 for a trial, a 2-year trial. And so, you know, I think it's both informative and necessary to work with companies these days. And so for researchers, it's very difficult to say no to just looking at input substitution products, as we would call it. But to get farmers to, I think, level two and three is going to be a matter of education and trainings, you know, bringing Dr. Bird to speak. We bring him in all the time to talk about getting to that next level, looking at the farmer as an ecosystem, I think will definitely help. But did Jim leave? Because Jim Riddle is a certifier that works with organic farm, or he was a certifier. He worked with organic farmers and an inspector trainer. And I would like to hear his opinion, because he works with organic farmers all the time. And I can imagine that he would say something like, you have to show it's profitable. The bottom line. I mean, if farmers can have systems where they don't use any spray treatments at all, including organic herbicides, and they can get a good return, though they'll stick with it. Are you going to add to that question? Or?
No, actually, I'm going to add a comment or a question, really. I just want to bring up the importance of public education and public awareness in terms of preferences, because we have moved from conventional, where we use a lot of spraying, and we produce this beautiful product, crops from the farm, and yet we would like to get into organic production, where we really would like to encourage beneficial will only exist in the presence of host, which we actually would have to feed on crops and would have to sustain some damage. Now the main problem is, why can we not educate the public that a little blemish is acceptable? Right. And I think we still have maintained the same requirement in terms of aesthetics. And I think that's a very, very big hurdle for us in terms of marketing. In crop production, in organic crop production, there's a whole lot of waste. And that's the main thing that, you know, you can convert that place, minimize, I mean, if you can actually, you know, have the public accept small amount of damage, you can still convert it into profit. And the main problem is organic farmers actually have very small leverage, or at least a small amount of clearance to make profit because of those loss in terms of damage by insects. And also I'd like to ask Dr. Byrd about the world's perspective in terms of developing countries who are engaged in organic production, because the standards between developing countries and developed countries like U.S. are very, very different.
Sorry, that's a great question. I hope you can stay till the end, because they're keeping us on a strict schedule, and it's time for the next speaker, 11 o'clock. So, George, do you mind waiting that till the end? Because that's a great discussion item. All right, thank you all for your great questions and comments. And, Pat, I think it's going to be an ongoing thing we're going to address.